Hello, this is Richard Wilson, and welcome to this expert audio interview with Frank Casey, expert on family offices, alternative investments, and fraud. Frank has over 37 years of experience in these areas, and he was a member of the team which blew the whistle to the SEC on Madoff. Frank, thanks for joining us today for this interview.
My pleasure, Richard.
Great. So just to start with, for people that don't know your background or haven't seen you speak already at a conference, what is kind of your story of how you got to where you are today in relation to family offices and kind of managing fraud risk and identifying that?
Okay. Richard, I started in the financial industry back in 1974. I was going to be a career Army officer. I was Airborne Ranger qualified infantry captain, but Merrill Lynch was recruiting heavily in the bottom of a big bear market in 1974. They were recruiting a lot of military people because we followed orders, basically. So I left the service and joined Merrill Lynch. And in those days, finding clients was a tough business. And so I wanted to differentiate myself. Equity options began trading on the exchanges in 74. So I designed an options covered writing program. Mm-hmm. And I had the help of a 24-year-old PhD in math from MIT who mm-hmm. became a client of mine. And we used to work on the first home computer, which was a four-drawer filing cabinet-looking thing, a digital PDP-11 for the older folks that might remember these things. And we came up with the various options strategies. We did buy the stock and sell the out-of-money calls to generate additional income. And that business I built from 74 through 78 for Merrill Lynch. It was predominantly a high net worth individual investment business, some small corporation or risks. Mm-hmm. I moved over to basically build a brand new department for Merrill Lynch in New England, which was corporate risk management. I had about five, six brokers working with me. And we would hedge out raw material costs. I became a de facto oil trader and arbitrageur for oil companies up in New England. I did that until about 82, using mostly futures contracts and the hedge raw material costs. I saw that banks were in big trouble with the S&L crisis and so forth, and I believed that with Volcker coming in, interest rates would spike. And so, consequently, I thought the banks needed a hedging regimen. And it took me a couple of years, but I was brought all the jobs by Bear Stearns and Prudential Securities, and I went with Prudential Securities in 82 and was the first guy to develop a bank risk management model. I am not a quant by design, but I've always been able to use those with tremendous quantitative skills to basically harbor, to group their talents into an effective fighting force, if you will. So in Prudential Securities, we had a team that was formed in Chicago. We named it the Institutional Financial Futures Group. I was up in New England, in Boston, and I became a hedger for banks and tumbled to the mortgage banks because they were just like oil companies, an upside-down triangle standing on a very small capital base on its point with a big pipeline of risk on the other side. And that pipeline of risk, my job was to balance that triangle from moving left to right and with the swings in interest rates. So I used derivatives, three derivatives removed from the underlying. I was hedging Fannie and Freddie Mae coupon bond origination with options on futures contracts on treasury notes and treasury bonds against the Fannie and Ginnie and Freddie's. Mm-hmm. Did that for 10 years. I was always pretty much corporate, as you can tell. And then I start shifting back into the high net worth family office marketplace around 92. But in the process of doing so, I landed up at a firm called Rampart Investment Management in Boston. And that was predominantly an institutional firm also. We were options experts in the equity options arena. And that's where I met Harry Markopoulos and Neil Cello, and began ferreting out that Madoff was a fraud in the spring of 98. spring of 99, excuse me, and we began publishing in 2000 in May to the SEC to no avail, blowing the whistle for 8 years. And there were family offices that were heavily investing, and wealthy families, through private wealth management banks in France and Switzerland and so forth, and mm-hmm. some quote-unquote hedge funds of funds, which were nothing more than really feeder funds in the United States. And I saw these institutions basically executing what I will call willful blindness.
Mm-hmm.
They did not want to see or hear from a group of quote-unquote competitors that the emperor had no clothes. And the reason that they didn't want to hear it is they were making too much money at it as institutions feeding wealthy people into it. I didn't really get to meet a family that had actually personally invested until about 30 days before Madoff blew in November of 2008. And when I found this family, it was just a crying shame. And I tried to do everything I could for them to convince them that they had made a mistake, but they didn't listen, as no one had listened, and consequently lost all of their money.
Right.
And since that time, Richard, what I've been doing now, and our investigations on Madoff culminated with his capitulation in December of 2008. So we had worked on it from 98, pretty much, or 99, through 2008. And since that time, I have been increasingly moving back towards families because I think that a couple things have happened on Wall Street that is going to change the whole structure of the way wealth is managed in the United States. First of all, I think that many of the Wall Street investment banks have treated, too many of them, have treated their clients as prey. Not when I say dumb equity, I don't mean the investors are dumb. What I'm saying is that you need they treat them as dumb equity because they needed to have a conduit, a place to move their product, and they would build very complicated structures like collateralized debt obligations and like, and sell these to investors, many of which were wealthy families. And consequently, I think that there is a distrust. I know there's a massive distrust of quote-unquote Wall Street and investment banks. Now, many of these investment banks have wealth management departments, and what we're beginning to see now is a movement of these wealth management teams out of some of the firms that have been tainted by Madoff and or other debacles and financially. And they're moving into smaller regional banks and brokers and so forth, or setting up independent registered investment advisories. And, and the reason there is that these wealth management teams perhaps were at these big investment banks for three reasons. The name, the panache, the branding, of course, the confidence that it exuded. Number two, the balance sheet, because people felt confident like keeping their money there. And three, proprietary product, because these guys had trading firms and so forth and hedge funds that were embedded or serviced, and consequently the deal flow, idea flow was considered to be a currency. Well, the name's blown, the balance sheet is delevered from 33 to 1 to 12 to 1. They're getting rid of the prop trading desk to reduce risk exposures, and so the wealth management teams are spinning out. And I believe, I spoke at a family office grouping. I was invited to a dinner down in Wilmington, Delaware, hosted by three families. And they brought the brightest minds on. I don't know how I got invited. But in various fields, scientific fields and so forth. And it's called the Non-Obvious Dinner. What a blast this thing was. If you ever get listeners ever get a chance to attend one, these non-obvious dinners, each person, their ticket to the free dinner, of course, was that they had to come up with an idea that was not obvious, but might change the world. And you argued your case, first at the table and then table against table, and then the winner was selected. And I argued the case that we're heading back to the future. we are going to go back to the House of Morgan concept. Some families are going to band together, each family having an expertise in a particular area, be it private equity, energy, financial risk management, whatever. And they will form teams that band together, almost as a confederacy, as you say, to basically service their peers on a peer-to-peer basis. Mm-hmm. And they will perhaps waive out salaries because the families are already paying the salaries. And so the fees would be more of a general partner, limited partner, sharing expenses, but no salaries. And the GP perhaps gets paid a little kicker at the end for taking the initiation, the initial risk. And so I suspect that we were going to move that way. Now, that begs the question. How does a family office who has perhaps $200-400 million, $1 billion or whatever, but it, how does it build staff, keep its overhead down around 1% or less, and effectively attract talent for specialized areas of investment? Mm-hmm. You really can't do it efficiently and effectively. Mm-hmm. And so my argument is that teams of advisors such as myself and my compatriots will service those families to provide staff extension ad hoc as needed to help them basically create, say, peer groups of the managers and the areas that they want to look at. So if, let's say, a family or a confederacy of families come and they say, listen, Frank, we need to look at some long, short specialist equity managers, some distressed managers, some emerging markets managers. We want some emerging managers in emerging markets or whatever. Mm-hmm. Our grouping would be able to deliver to them all of the due diligence on peer groups. So we might provide a dozen names in each sector. The CIO of the family would then select the top three or four managers out of each peer group, perhaps put together a sample portfolio for a conservative account, an income account, an aggressive account, and so forth. And but the family participants could select dynamically across these peer group buckets to their own liking. So they may say, I really don't care about volatility in the short term. I'm willing to accept illiquidity. I want to do more distressed managers, and I want to be more heavily weighted on that end.
Right. I see. So it seems like in the past I've identified three reasons why family offices are growing. I think that some wealth management firms are now liking to call themselves multifamily offices in their attempt to get higher-end clients. Some multifamily offices that used to have $50 million minimums have lowered those in this economy to $25 million. And then I've seen in some countries, such as Russia, that traditionally everybody is invested in commercial real estate and apartment buildings, but now there's a greater need for diversified investing and tax management. So family offices are kind of coming at the need of investors in some countries, such as Russia and India in China. But it seems like you've identified another source of growth, is that lots of the wealth managers from large investment banks and well-known banks are moving out, and they would rather work independently as an RIA and set up a multifamily office rather than work underneath the large bank brand. Is that right?
That's correct. I have a friend, Gary Brandt, up in outside of Toronto, and Gary was became the head of Canada Trust's wealth management division at one point in his past, and he quintupled the assets under management and tripled the profit margin in 5 years by basically firing all in-house managers, going to the best of the best of breed, outsourced managers. The individual wealth manager, knowing their clients' risk tolerances, time horizons, and the like, could pick managers that were approved by the Canada Trust platform, and Gary's team basically would ferret out the best managers and put them onto the platform. So you see a lot of quote-unquote even wealth management banks, trust departments at banks, that while they may be very good at handling traditional stocks and bonds, how do they expand their operation into alternatives or specialized investments? And so in order to produce an excess return for a given amount of risk, or what we call alpha in our business, one really has to have an ability to ferret out in the capital market structures globally inefficiencies. Because the markets are generally efficient the more liquid and deep they go. And so the inefficiencies usually come from finding areas that are less liquid and therefore less covered. So in the world of traditional stock investing, one might think micro cap value or growth. Fewer analysts following it. Why? No investment banking business to be had by Wall Street, so no analysts are assigned to it. Now, that means that experts in that area, and maybe even industry-specific, healthcare, energy, microcap, gold mining, microcap, those people that deal in a rather inefficient sector where there's not a lot of liquidity and have a specific industry knowledge, they offer an alpha potential. But how does one ferret out the good managers from the bad? How does one determine whether it's fraudulent or is there a good due diligence process in place? How do you do that with limited staff? And whether you be a wealth management team that's spun out, a big wealth management division of a trust company, the chances are that you do not have enough people to do that job efficiently. So I believe that the wave of the future and what I'm positioning myself for is the ability to deliver talent that I have vetted with first as a manager of manager and an advisor to create a staff extension very efficiently at a low cost, and then allow the internal CIO of the organization or the patriarch of the firm to basically work with us. And so we become, in essence, a sous chef, and they're the main chef.
Right, right. That makes sense. So you help bring resources to the team so they don't have to hire somebody full-time that has a lot of experience in kind of vetting managers, because typically analysts, you know, relatively little amount of experience. Otherwise, they're extremely expensive to keep on board full time, right?
That's it, Richard. You've hit it. So, I mean, if I can, for instance, in my manager-of-manager association on the hedge fund discipline side, I deal with a group of guys called Skyview Investment Advisors out of Shrewsbury, New Jersey. Now, they are the old Gartmore Riverview group. They ran $2 billion in mostly bespoke or customized portfolios, predominantly for the general accounts of insurance companies. They also ran a fund of funds. So these guys have tremendous pedigree and depth. Like most great managers and analysts, they're really not necessarily great at relating or marketing, okay? And so sure. People like myself, not as a third-party marketer, but as a special principal or partner, basically are in charge now with the responsibility of building those businesses. So in our case, for instance, none of us are drawing salaries. We're basically building this company out, and I'm building bespoke or customized relationships with families. I have the exact same thing going with Stark Research, Dan Stark, who's probably got the largest database on, and the oldest database on commodity trading advisors, and Rick Barrett at Granite Asset Management, who's been basically putting together, as a commodity pool operator, teams of these CTAs. So they're my partners also. And then my third partner, for instance, is Jack Schwager, Market Wizard, same. And I'm building a long-only commodity investable index that will beat Goldman Sachs and Jimmy Rogers and the other ones, because it has a systematic risk-managed allocation process. So right. We're always long commodities. We can't be short, but dynamically we select which commodities to invest in and wait accordingly.
Right, that makes sense. Okay, and before I move into kind of your tips risk approach, you know, how do you think that managers as a best practice, how should managers who've done their homework, they have everything in place, they should, before approaching family offices, what do you think the best way is for them to reach out to somebody like yourself who would serve on an investment committee or be a partner with a family office or reach out directly to a family office? What's the best strategy or method for an investment fund manager to do so? Because I know many people see family offices as relatively secretive. Lots of times phone calls go unreturned, you know, emails go unanswered, and people just kind of give up because it's a frustrating process.
Absolutely. There again, most marketers at a hedge fund will tell you their rate of return and maybe a little bit about what they do. But they don't really delineate. What if I was receiving this email, and I receive a lot of these emails from managers who would like my team members to allocate to them. And when I receive these emails, it's amazing to me. Okay, here's our monthly return, and here's our, you know, here's the area, generally a little bit about the market and what we did maybe in a general fashion.
Right.
Well, telling me the rate of return without telling me the risk assumptions under which you made those returns doesn't mean anything to me.
Right.
And what I'm really focused in on is, okay, if I believe that you are your ability to make a return is usually due to your ability to ferret out an inefficient area of a capital market structure, in other words, put it simply, what makes you so brilliant that you could make that return? Well, I've identified, for instance, these small companies that are doing XYZ in this area of the business. They're selling at four times to five times EBITDA. They're selling four times net cash on the books, you know, and the next year they got $6 billion in cash. I mean, they're going to be able to hire the right people or somebody's going to buy them out. Okay, so whatever the argument is, they have to identify the area of inefficiency that they're targeting, why they've been able to exploit it, and then they should include a due diligence package that in summary form, not your 75-page prospectus. I mean, I've read more 75 to 80-page prospectuses, and I'll tell you, they all tell you, Richard, the same thing. In
right.
summary, the manager can do anything, anywhere, anytime, to whomever, in any methodology that they want. So, you know, they're written by lawyers to defend the manager. Forget the big prospectus. Give me a due diligence questionnaire that you worked up yourself that addresses predominantly the qualitative side of the due diligence. Everybody seems to lock on to the metrics of the quantitative side. How was the strategy? What did it do in the return to its risk and drawdown? Well, great. That's good, that because at least you're identifying the risk. But the big risk and three-quarters of the due diligence process is really the qualitative side of the ledger, and very few people address that. So I guess the answer, in summary, I think managers need to report into databases and managers of managers, and then the managers of managers ferret out the peer group rankings, and then they provide those as staff extension to family offices. It's really just a twist on a fund-to-funds concept, and it's no more expensive. Matter of fact, bespoke or customized portfolio work you can get for about a third to a half the price of a traditional funds-to-funds. Traditional funds-to-funds will try to make about 1.5% in a normal period, 2%. 2.5% in an extraordinary period and knock the cover off the balls, 3%. You can come in and hire any one of my teams, for instance, or teams like ours, for a consulting fee of 50 basis points and maybe a little hurdle over a base level rate of return.
Sure. Okay. And so basically to summarize, or put in different words, basically if you're sending emails out to family offices, keep it really to the point about what makes your firm unique and how you have the skill, ability, research, team to find and take advantage of some inefficiency in the marketplace and then provide a short qualitative DDQ that's you've made up, and it's not a bunch of legal jargon, basically. Is that right?
That's correct. You've nailed it, Richard.
Okay, great. So I want to move into the topic that you're often asked to speak about at conferences and dinners and seminars, and that is your kind of risk framework for approaching fraud risk, which is sometimes referred to as headline risk. And I believe you call it TIPS. Could you kind of explain how you came up with that and what TIPS stands for?
Sure. It's an acronym, ex-military guy, right? I mean, we all had acronyms.
Right.
Identify long military phrases, okay? And so, but the acronym TIPS, to me, covers all of the salient points of due diligence. And TIPS, the T stands for third-party verification. Mm-hmm. The I stands for internal controls. The P stands for the pedigree. And the S stands for strategy. Now, of the TIPS, and I'll go into each one in a moment, mm-hmm. TIP are predominantly qualitative. Well, and then in strategy, the S is maybe three-quarters quantitative, but still a qualitative piece into it. So mm-hmm. due diligence, back in the old days, when hedge funds of the old days being about 1998, I remember when we discovered Bernie Madoff. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, he was doing a strategy that he claimed could produce 1% consistently a month, and he had no drawdowns. And that strategy was a strategy I was using in 74 through 78. Mm-hmm. Covered call writing. Well, I knew damn darn well what covered call writing does not do.
Right.
It does not produce 1% a month because it is a path-dependent strategy. You still have to pick the right stocks to go up, and that's how you made your money. Mm-hmm. And so the option income coming in was just considered an extra dividend, right? So you would have back in the inefficient days when options first started in 74, 75, I could write covered calls to a 12% to 15% call away. So I buy a stock at 30, sell a 35 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Make 15-17% per year on balance on a portfolio. As the markets became more efficient, covered call writing didn't produce those things. So I knew it didn't produce 1% a month. So
right.
The first thing in TIPS, is third-party verification. I was a third-party verifier knowing that that strategy didn't work, right? And
right.
So you have to have somebody who understands the strategy that you're potentially investing in, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but third-party verification really looks down to checks and balances. Consider it just like you would a normal good business. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You would want a good administrator who's separate from the manager. You would want an auditor that's a high-quality auditor, and more importantly, an auditor that actually understood the business they're auditing.
Mm-hmm.
You'd want, if you were doing brokerage work, you would want that to be third-party. You wouldn't want the manager being the broker, right?
Right,
because
right.
There's a potential conflict. Your custody of your money. Why would you even want the money at a brokerage firm? Why not keep it at a trustee bank separate and have a delivery versus purchase arrangement, DVP?
Right.
So you can, and many people, because of the collapse of Bear and Lehman and so forth, have moved to a third-party custodian now.
Mm-hmm.
You want the net asset value, or whether it be daily or monthly, to be struck and verified by third parties, not just provided by the manager. And so Bernie, by the way, failed on every one of those things. Bernie was a self-administrator. He did his, supposedly father-in-law doing the audit. It was basically a man and a dog in a strip mall in New York State. It wasn't even his brother-in-law. He did his own brokerage and trading. He did his own custody work. And his NAV, net asset value, client statements were totally bogus. He basically, you should also understand in third-party verification that what the strategy is and what it should produce.
Right. Wow. So it sounds like it's what you were referring to earlier about them kind of willfully looking the other way just because they wanted to, you know, impress their boss or impress their ultra high net worth family or impress their clients with these consistent returns that kind of make them look good, right?
Yeah, that, and there was tremendous conflict. People were conflicted all along the pipeline. What happened with some of these funds of funds that where they had analysts inside of these funds of funds with chartered financial analyst designation, financial risk manager designations? These people, whether they did their homework or not, I don't know. I suspect what happened was when they first were hired, they were asked to do checks and balances and do due diligence. They came up with a whole bunch of questions, and the bosses basically buried it with willful blindness because they were just making too much money at it. Ernie, talk about a conflicted arrangement. The wealth management banks, the funds of funds that invested in Madoff, were charging their clients a percent, let's just call it a percent or some basis points thereof, to basically run that client's money. They were being paid an extra 2 to 4% by Bernie per year for providing the capital and without disclosing it.
Right.
And so they were conflicted all over the place. And so what's an investor to do? Well, I wouldn't trust the statements unless I had my own auditor doing something and double-checking. And the way Bernie used to handle that, by the way, on the bottom of his statements, it said, it would say, not to be used for your tax return. Auditors that were hired by wealthy clients would call Bernie's office and say, hey, I need to check on this or that. And he would say, listen, if you want to check on this or that, we're going to give you back your money. And then the client would wave his own auditor off because he didn't want to be deemed out because it was just the goose that was laying the golden eggs, you know?
Right, right. That makes sense. Okay. And so TIPS is a third-party verification as the first part.
I as internal controls. Okay. Now, when you look at a manager, you want to look at what is his record of compliance? I mean, does he have a compliance manual? Does it specify checks and balances inside of one's organization? Mm-hmm. You want segregation of the responsibilities. You don't want the trader also running the books. I mean, Barings went down that bank because the trader was running the book and play with the numbers and had a shadow account that no one even knew about. So, for which the bank's balance sheet was at risk. So you want to have double checks everything. One of the management firms that I worked with in the past, a merchant bank in London, I was a consultant to them, they had a fellow who ran the due diligence side who was at one time a brain surgeon. And he basically discovered hedge funds in his 30s, and when he began studying hedge funds, he said to himself, the qualitative side is missing in the due diligence regimen on a lot of these firms, and on top of it, those that have the qualitative side don't apply it in any systematic format. So he created a whole checklist, and each item had to be initialed off by the person doing the due diligence with date, time, and comment. So it was a standardized procedure on everything. And so some of these, a good part of this whole TIPS concept I gleaned off of him over the years. And what he always demanded, which I found very interesting, was a CFO in the linkage. Now, the hedge funds, the bigger ones, might have their own CFO. The funds of hedge funds should have an internal CFO. But a smaller manager can't afford a CFO, but maybe he should contract with a CFO. And the idea of the CFO is you want all of their pedigree basically at risk. They report to no one. And it's a series of internal checks and balances. They're going to make sure that the back office has depth to it. There's complexity in the firm's structure. It's not one or two people controlling everything. Madoff, believe it or not, was running his whole fraud out off of the third floor of of his office in the Lipstick Building, and no one was allowed down there except the people that were phoning up, the programmers that were phoning up the documents. And it was quite naive the way they were doing it. When after the fact, Harry Markopoulos, my investigative partner on that case, we wrote the book "No One Would Listen" about our story, and now the documentary "Chasing Madoff" will be released in late August here across 15 cities, and we'll see if it gets traction. But it's the story behind the story, basically what we were doing, and it's billed as a financial thriller. We had our panic. We were paranoid a little bit because we were dealing with one of the most powerful people on Wall Street, and nobody was listening to us. But in either case, when you look at this thing, what came out after the fact, each bank has a clearing number, and the same clearing number would show up in multiple banks, which made no sense. In other words, you know, such and such bank supposedly he was using had the same exact clearing number as another bank. No.
Right.
And so no one ever dealt, including the SEC, no one ever got a hold of the depository trust number, DTC number, and basically checked the counterpart on any one of his trades. They could have asked for his options trading desk. He was an options strategy, right? Okay, give me your options trading desk. He didn't have one. And if he had one, the next thing he would ask is, okay, give me a trade. And who's your DTC? What's your DTC number? And you look for the counterparty on time and sales. Very simple. These are red flags that we laid out for the SEC. We have 29 red flags in 26 pages, all documented case studies of who to call, when to do it, and what to look for. And they failed to pick up the phone on any of them because we were, quote, unquote, a competitor.
Right.
Who better to blow the whistle on a fraud than somebody that understands the business, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure. Wow. Okay. And so the next part of the TIPS process is really the part that kind of blinded everybody because of Madoff's, you know, connections and his kind of professional background. You know, people kind of didn't look at the other parts of the system that you're kind of putting forth here, right? This whole pedigree section.
Absolutely, the pedigree. This is the one that got everybody. And the pedigree on a couple levels. One, professionally, in his business, he was the chairman of NASDAQ. He was the developer of the electronic trading system. So, I mean, he was a bright man. I asked one of his major competitors in the earlier days, who was a founder of a major trading firm. I said to him, was your business profitable, and could Bernie make a lot of money doing it? I already knew the answer, but I wanted to hear it from him. And he says, oh, it was extremely profitable when the difference between the bid and the offer was at least 1/8 of a point, which is 12.5 cents, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes on certain markets, it was a quarter of a point. So we would buy on the bid side, sell on the offer side all day long, and we could make that spread. So that was very profitable. I said, well, when did it turn unprofitable? He said, when we went to decimalization and the bid-offer spread dropped to pennies. He says, we sold our business, and we could sat there and watch Bernie make money year after year after year. And we kept saying, how in the devil is this guy making money? But I believe personally, this is my own personal belief, if they ever find clean sets of books, you're going to find, I think, that to maintain his position as king of Wall Street, he was moving money from the Ponzi scheme over to his execution business.
Right.
To make him to continue to build himself out as the biggest on Wall Street, king of Wall Street. But everybody was blinded by his pedigree. The answer to pedigree is that if I'm speaking with a hedge fund manager and we figure out that we can't tumble to somebody we both kind of know personally within the 15 minutes of conversation, then because everybody's kind of linked in this field. It's not that big of a field. And if we can't tumble to some common ground that I can make a few phone calls and check, I'm going to really start digging. And no matter who it is, even if they have great pedigree and even if we know someone in common, I will never move forward without a background check by ex-FBI type of guys. And they're not that expensive. I mean, if you're going to make a major investment in a manager, what in the devil is $750 to $1,500 to do a background check on the guy?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And you'd be surprised what you find. I mean, Thierry de la Villiche was the poor gentleman that committed suicide after losing $1.4 billion with Madoff. Okay? Mm-hmm. Thierry de la Villiche, that's how I found Madoff in spring of 98. And Thierry de la Vinche was the ex-president of Credit Léonais USA. I mean, here's a man that is connected. And he knew most every private wealth management bank in Switzerland and France. He was royalty himself, in a way. He was a French nobleman. His family, we figured out later on, bailed out Louis XIV. I mean, this family, this man was connected, and I found him when he had $320 million with Madoff. We warned him, Harry and I warned him all through the years, and the reason we stayed in touch with him is because I built another business with Thierry, not related to Madoff.
Right.
And we tried to build a business with him, and I had hired a floor trader.
Mm-hmm.
Took him off the floor of an exchange in the options pits and moved into Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, I became very uncomfortable with the arrogance of this individual.
Mm-hmm.
And before he ever got a hold of a client dollar, I decided I called Curry and I said, we need a background check on this guy. And he said, oh, we checked him out. There's nothing on him. He's fine.
Right.
We hired Bo Deedle, the guy that's on with Imus in the morning. We hired Bo, one tough cop out of New York, and Bo came back and said, well, we can't find anything yet. I said, keep digging, Bo. I just feel it. The hair on the back of my neck was standing up. I didn't like the guy, and he came back. He said, we got him. He said, it took me sending a guy on to the West Coast to dig through the local court records, and buried in the court records was the fact that this guy was connected for interstate wire fraud. He was an FBI, he became an FBI informant, and hence the case was buried. And so immediately we held a summary court-martial and we fired this guy. But we protected ourselves because we were willing to hire private investigators. Some people are loath to do that because they feel, well, I won't get into the club. This guy won't take my money if I go snooping around.
Right.
Do yourself a favor. If the hair on the back of your neck stands up at all, walk away until it lies back down again.
Right.
Or keep digging.
Right. That's some great advice. I think lots of people do a very basic criminal background check, but not an investigative background check, in my experience.
Absolutely. And sometimes cases get buried.
Right. For sure. And then the last part of the tips process is on strategy or structure. And this is the part that you said does have a quantitative component to it,
but
still qualitative.
But still a qualitative side. For instance, you look at, if I told you, for instance, that if I gave you a chart of returns and it had very few blips and it was going up from the lower left to the upper right rather consistently on a 45-degree angle, or a 30-degree angle, you would probably tell me that that's the investment you would like to invest in, right?
Right.
Now, I can develop that chart by writing out-of-the-money options with no underlying equity in it. In other words, I can create for you a line that looks like that, and I will win 90% of the time picking up dimes in front of the steamroller.
Right.
And one day, I will gap open lower 30% to 50%.
Yeah.
Because I'm basically selling the equivalent. I'm doing the same thing if I were an insurance company underwriting catastrophic risk insurance and collecting premium. That's the line you're seeing, the premium intake. And I'm not reinsuring, so the margins are nice and fat. And I'm not diversifying my portfolio. And one of these days, the Hurricane Katrina hits, and I haven't bought reinsurance.
Right.
And you're gone. You're wiped out. So looking at the metrics of math and saying, oh, the reward to risk is very good. The Sharpe ratio is approaching 1.0, which is very good, or 1.5. That's extremely good. When you find managers that are running Sharpes of 5, 7, 10 to 1, something's wrong. And that's one thing. You've got to figure out where is the embedded risk. The other thing is each return profile has a certain volatility structure to it and pattern of return commensurate with its strategy. If you're doing an equity options writing program, it's more of a steady line. Even if it's a legit one, it's more of a steady line with no big swings but no big returns. If a guy tells you he's doing dynamic global tactical asset allocation or global macro work, mm-hmm. and he's got a nice steady rate of return, something is wrong, because that pattern is a pattern of, it looks like the sawtooth of a saw.
Right.
It's up and down, because there are tremendous swings in that marketplace, and they come at you blind, on your blind side.
Yep.
And so you've got to understand what the strategy is and what the pattern of return looks like. So if you're hunting bear, it should be a bear print, not a doe print or a
right.
lynx print. You understand? So
right.
as a hunter, as an analyst, you know what game you're hunting, and you know what the track should look like, the sign.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's a matter of matching sign to the animal that you're tracking. And it's the same thing here. So it's not just the metrics, it's the qualitative side. You have to understand what premium you're being paid for illiquidity. I mean, I saw this. I helped build a funds of funds tenfold to over 6 years to about $2 billion. And we moved from predominantly an 80% family office basis to 80% institutional basis during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, because we were all risk managers, even not me, who was a marketing guy, we would study the illiquidity of things. Now, let's take something called asset-backed lending. Sounds simple enough. You basically provide liquidity or financing to assets. And even though the asset has got a loan-to-market ratio of 50% or less, and so it seems like a very secure loan, and so forth and so forth. But they were being embedded inside of hedge funds that were providing monthly liquidity when the loan runoff was 18 to 24 months.
Right.
So, guess what happens? They get inside of funds of funds that are offering monthly liquidity. When I was competing on a fund of funds basis in finals, I was just amazed. These funds of funds competitors of mine were offering monthly liquidity to institutions investing $150 million per, and I'm saying, but I know that I feel strongly they have 25% or more of their money in asset-backed lending managers.
Right.
Well, sure enough, when the illiquidity hits and people demand their money back, then these loans are sold not at, it's the joke on Wall Street is when you're a manager and you call up the trading desk of the various firms for asset-backed lending or any illiquid structured finance like a CDO or whatever, and it comes up with a debt obligation or mortgage obligation, and you say, I need a mark, and they'll say, oh, for the book or for a trade? The reason is, for the book, it's 98-102 that offer. Oh,
right.
You want to sell 30 million? 70 bid. And that's
right.
What happened. I mean, because they couldn't hedge off the other side of the trade efficiently. And if everybody's selling, and that's what's happened to a lot of these structured finance deals that are even the governments are buying out paper at 60 cents on the dollar when the actual market value of that paper is even 38 cents today.
Right.
It's amazing, because you can't move that much paper that's illiquid, so you have to understand the liquidity of the trade. Not what they tell you in the documents that they're going to provide you, but the
right.
actual underlying liquidity of the instruments that they're invested in. The liquidity of the instruments must match the liquidity of the structure.
Right.
Okay? And
right.
all of these things, for people that are, I guess what I'm saying is, if you're going to go into a military conflict,
mm-hmm.
if your job is to charge the hill, you don't do it without proper support from air cover, artillery cover, ammunition
right.
and supply. You must have the proper talent to protect yourself and achieve your mission. If your
mm-hmm.
mission as an investor or family office is to invest in some alternatives, and by the way, people say, well, I'll never do alternatives. Well, guess what? If you, even as a pension manager, if you have an actuarial assumption of 8%, wait, and bonds are yielding you 2.5 to 3.5.
Right.
And you're not getting it there. And then you're going to tell me that you're going to get it from the stock market with consistency, 10 years, 11 years, it's had a zero return. So pick your assumption on the stock market. As some people say, I can't get there from here without alternatives. I just don't want more of the same, thank you. They want more transparency. They want a delineation on the liquidity and the potential risk of illiquidity. They need help in advisory, building their own personalized portfolios. And they don't want to buy off-the-shelf products because they don't get the level of transparency and the due diligence regimens under what I call TIPS, third-party verification, internal controls, the pedigree flags, and the strategy metrics, both qualitative and quantitative.
Right, right. No, that makes a lot of sense. That's it's one of the components, I think that last component, sometimes people focus on that almost exclusively, yet even though they're kind of playing in that sandbox during maybe 80% of the DDQ process, I don't think oftentimes they look at deer tracks as deer tracks and bear tracks as bear tracks. They just look for something that falls in this ratio with this track record, with this AUM, and they want to check all the 40 boxes. And if those 40 boxes get checked, then we, you know, move them up to the next level of the investment committee, et cetera. So I think that's pretty an interesting approach. And I think that I actually just have one last question here. I just have 1 or 2 minutes left here for the interview. When it comes to governance practices at family offices and at hedge funds, but mostly at family offices, do you see that governance boards are being built, which are kind of external and look out for the greater good of those families within the family office, that are kind of, they're kind of separate independent governance boards? Do you see more governance processes and boards going in place, or do you think that people are just going to be a bit more strict on their DDQ processes than they were before Madoff? What do you think is the reaction right now?
And no,
now?
I think they're onto something very interesting here in governance boards and providing stewardship for the money. You know, family offices are more akin to corporations. I was a corporate risk manager for many years. Family offices don't have a homogenous portfolio. Family offices have short-term liabilities, intermediate-term liabilities, and long-term liabilities. Short-term is to keep the family going, educate the kids, whatever. Intermediate might be that you want to do X, Y, Z and get, until you get a liquidity event, or you've had your liquidity event. You want to create an environment where you can fund certain charities and so forth intermediately. Long-term might be when you want to liquidate your wealth and endow a museum or whatever. Now, whatever those liability streams are, they have different time horizons. And because of that, they can accept the various levels of illiquidity and volatility matched to the time horizon. And what you need to do as a family office is not chase the hot dot. You need and look at the manager and say, oh, this month he's up or he's down, and how do you do against his competitors? The more important question for the family office is, what type of strategies and managers should I build within each one of these asset buckets that match the liability bucket? You want liquid alpha or liquid alternatives, perhaps in your stocks and bonds for your short-term liabilities. You can go a little more illiquid, such as distressed or event-driven things, activism and so forth like that, and reshaping corporations in your intermediate bucket. In your long-term bucket, you can look at emerging markets, emerging managers, and other things where you can hit the long ball, perhaps, and you know you're going to accept illiquidity, more private equity, and so forth, and those are buckets. But that is, sounds like it's a CIO function only, but no, it's actually a governance board function, too. And one of the things that family offices struggle with all the time, I believe, and wealthy individuals, is they go to their accountant, and their accountant says one thing. They go to their lawyer, they take that back, and they're sitting there trying to triage that. And then they go to their financial advisor, and they're getting a feedback loop, and they're triaging that. Take all of your advisors, your brokers, your asset managers, your legal guys, and your accountants. Put them on a continuum, a commitment fee, and they come to a quarterly meeting just like a board of directors. Decisions are made at the quarterly meeting, and they battle it out there. The family office member should not, the head of the family office should not be trying to adjudicate and triage all of this information flows in each one of them individually in a silo. They have to be brought into the fore and argued out for the good of the family.
Right. That makes sense. I think that kind of is a case for moving to a family office from a wealth management firm as well, you know, besides tax efficiency management over your whole financial picture. I think just having all those people in the same room is one of the reasons why I think more family offices are being formed, so that that person who's very busy, oftentimes running a business, or finally they're not busy because they just sold their business, isn't the person running around talking to their seven different experts and trying to make sense of all their advice, right?
There you go. Bring them into a board of directors, a governance board, stewardship of the money, and making sure that the objectives, the terms of objectives, the asset building that you're doing is partitioned to match the liability streams of the family.
Right. Okay. Great. Well, thank you for all your time today. I think that's a great comment in the discussion on, and your tips approach is something I think that many single family offices as well as multifamily offices will be able to take notes on, and perhaps listen to this interview a second time, but just take detailed notes on all the advice that Frank has given here for each section of that tips process. I think that's really valuable advice that almost any family office can look at what they're doing and kind of adjust their process based on your advice, or maybe find at least one or two areas they could improve. So thanks, Frank, for your advice again here today. Really appreciate your time and insights.
My pleasure. By the way, I will have my website up shortly, frankcasey.com, CASEY, frankcasey.com, and I will be putting all of this material up onto the website, and so people can go look at it at their leisure.
That's great. Great. Thanks for
Okay, thank you,
great
Richard.
resource. Thank you.
Cheers.
Take care.